Hello and welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And we're live on tape from Dublin. This time, we are going to talk about the Beatles at Christmas. And this is going to be part one of a two-part episode. And how we're going to do this is we're going to look at every Christmas in the 1960s, from 1960 to 69, and look at a little snapshot of how the Beatles were at each Christmas to kind of have a look at how their career progressed across the decade. What we're going to do is we're going to wind back to the pre-fame days, and we're going to go back to December 1960. And we're going to start right there and see what the Beatles were up to. And the interesting thing about 1960 is that's the year where they first go to Hamburg. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, this is the year where they become like the hot live band. So, you know, in May of 1960, they go off and tour with Johnny Gentle. Then in August, they get the opportunity very quickly to go to Hamburg. So they hire up Pete Best. They go off to Hamburg and they're in Hamburg from 17th of August till the end of November 1960. And so when we get to December 1960, we're in the post-flush of their first round at Hamburg. And yet, and Lewison describes this very well in his book, there's kind of almost an air of despondency, like they think that that was the pinnacle, that that's it, that it's over.
Yeah, I think by the end of December, there is this real sense of a pivotal moment. Are they going to continue? Will they be able to pick up after coming back from Hamburg, or is this really effectively the end of the band? It's a very interesting period in that immediate run-up to December, and you can see that that really is the key point.
Yeah, where they have to make a decision about what they're going to do.
They have to make a decision, and really, I think it's Lennon has to make the decision.
Yes, and it's you know the way they left Hamburg is pretty well documented. That George gets deported on the 21st of November 1960, then Paul and Pete get deported on the 30th of November 1960, and then John ends up returning on his own, but he doesn't return on his own till the 10th of December 1960. Yeah. And Stuart Sutcliffe at that point kind of leaves the band. He stays behind with Astrid.
He is basically out of the band at that stage. He's with Astrid. He's staying in Germany. George, by way of background, he's deported simply for being underage.
Yeah.
What had happened at this point was they were told at the beginning of November that their contract with the Kaiser Keller Club, that Bruno Koschmider had said, that's it, I'm terminating the contract. They were preparing to move across to the Top Ten Club, which was Peter Eckhorn. The manager there had offered them a contract. George was gone, and Mark Lewison, in his book, describes George teaching John the lead guitar parts sort of so that they could carry on. So there doesn't seem to be any sense at that point that even though George was leaving, you know, that wasn't the rest of the band were staying.
And so do we know how long, you know, if all that stuff hadn't happened, do we know how long they were planning to stay? Were they planning to stay into 61?
My understanding is they were due to stay on into 61, but they say they left. Yeah. The Kaiser Keller Koschmider, I think, in fact, had terminated the contract. And I think this it was an increasingly sort of fractious relationship. And I think what predates that termination of the contract is this story about breaking up the stage in the Kaiser Keller, where Rory Storm and the Hurricanes, the Beatles, other people performing, got it into their head that this would be hilariously funny if they stomped so hard on the stage that they would smash up the stage. And I think it was effectively Rory Storm that succeeded one night in breaking the stage.
Right.
But basically, I think Koschmider had decided he'd had enough of these kind of rock and roll layabouts, lights. He had terminated the contract and they were moving to the Top Ten.
Yes. And, you know, it's interesting, you know, how in retrospect it might only seem like a week or two that separates Paul and Pete going back and then John coming back. But obviously at the time, when there's no kind of mass communications or they're not able to keep in touch, nobody really knows what's going on. So when Paul and Pete Best come back to Liverpool, there's no real knowledge about when John is going to reappear. And John, he makes a very lonely trip back to Liverpool, and he kind of realises for all the months in Hamburg, there's no money, he's exhausted, he's that's the first time they've ever given their nervous systems, to use the George speak. Yeah. And they kind of have a post-Hamburg PTSD almost, where they're kind of shook to their core from that.
Yeah, I think what you have to bear in mind is that each of them went to Hamburg against the wishes or against the judgment of their parents, or in John's case, his aunt. So yeah. They left full of this sort of enthusiasm and this ambition, and they're going to make their money, they make their living doing this. There was money to be had, and each of them is sort of slinking back under very ignominious circumstances. So George makes that kind of lonely trip back, yeah, through London, and then up to carrying a lot of gear and needing porters at the station to get this home. And he says literally he arrived home, he was flat broke. He had used any money he had spent getting a home.
Yes.
Pete and Paul were deported, so they're like, they are literally taken to the airport
and seen off.
And seen off by, yeah, the German police. I think Peter Eckhorn, the top 10 manager, had to foot the bill for at least part of their trip home. But they left without their equipment.
Yeah.
Then John comes home and he gives an interview much, much later describing how he kind of came home with his amp on his back. Literally, this is an amp that he hadn't paid for. He was petrified it was going to get stolen. He arrives back and he's kind of knocking on the door of his aunt's,
yeah,
you know, destitute. This hasn't worked.
And he gets home on about the 10th of December, and he doesn't contact Paul until around the 15th of December is what we know.
Yeah.
Which is, so he's at home sitting on his own stewing for 5 days. You know, it's in the fortnight before Christmas. And what I like about this story is that even though it's only about 2.5 weeks since Paul has been kicked out of Hamburg, he's managed to get himself a job.
Yeah.
And this is one of these things that looms large in the McCartney legend. You know, well, I had a job for a while and I went off and I was, and he writes songs about being on the bus and all that stuff. But like, when you look at it in the timeline, it's like, oh, he had a job for like 2 weeks or so.
Yeah.
And eventually Lennon reaches out to Paul, rocks up and says, well, what are we going to do?
Yeah.
And they very quickly make a decision then that they play their first post-Hamburg show, which seems to be a casual type of thing, with in Mona Best's Casbah Club on the 17th of December.
Yeah. So I'll say yes, I think it's an accidental meeting initially, that George bumps into John, and then Paul describes them, the two of them coming around and saying, right, and he's thinking, well, I've got a job. Yeah. Should I, you know, I'm
so we have him in the anthology here. One day John and George showed up in the yard and I should have been sweeping it, and they told me we'd a gig. And I said, no, I have a steady job here and it pays £7.14 a week and I'm getting training. And then he said, sod it, and he bunked over the wall. And
Massey and Coggan's loss was the pop world's gain.
Yes, in retrospect.
I think in retrospect we can say that that's fair enough. So, yeah, John describes George being angry, mm-hmm, whenever he realizes Lennon's been home for a few days.
Because he's thinking, touch,
you
know, yeah,
you haven't been in touch. We could have been gigging. We could have been earning money. But I think it's an indication of the sort of the depth of the despondency, that Lennon is really, this is the crunch time. What are they going to do? Is this going to be a career? Is this going to be a hobby? Or do they just kick it to the side of the road?
But it's obvious when they hit the stage on the Casbah on the 17th of December that they are not the same band that last played Liverpool in,
yes,
the middle of the summer. That they are a different kind of, there's been a transformative change. And so, again, very, very quickly, a number of gigs just appear in that Christmas period on either side of Christmas Day, which are kind of pivotal in how the Beatles went from being, you know, knocking around Liverpool, having a laugh, to becoming a band with the potential to be a professional operation.
Yes, and I mean, the Casbah gig on the 17th, what you've got to realise is, you know, they didn't have their bass player. He'd stayed back in Germany. They didn't have equipment.
Yeah.
So they had to borrow equipment from another band in order to actually put that gig on. They got Chaz Newby, who was in another band, a guitar player, to play bass.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very sort of ramshackle outfit in that sense, but clearly there's something different.
Yes. And on the back of that gig on the 17th, Alan Williams, their de facto manager at the time, on the 19th of December books them a gig for the 24th for Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
So it's all happening quite quickly, and that's at the Grosvenor Volume, the Grosvenor Ballroom in Liskeard Wallasey. And they had played there before, But now, you know, these gigs that they play across Christmas, I'm just looking at the list here, they play Litherland Town Hall on the 27th, which was a welcome home gig booked by Bob Wooler, another gig on the 31st of December. And it seems to be that Litherland Town Hall gig on the 27th of December is an explosive, pivotal, people who were there kind of say this was a magnificent
yes
change.
So this seems to be what crystallized the decision we're going to stick with this. Lennon in the anthology, there was an interview from 1967 that was shown in anthology, and he said that was the evening we really came out of our shell and let go. We stood up there and we were being cheered for the first time. This is when we began to think that we were good. Up to Hamburg we thought we were okay but not good enough. And so this is the point where suddenly, from the depths of despondency, they suddenly get this massive boost.
Yes.
By this one single gig.
And it says, Pete Best sort of says, you know, they played to about 1,500 people on the dance floor at the time. But to quote Pete, they stopped dancing when we played and they surged forward in a crowd to be nearer to us, to watch every moment and above all, to scream. Which is kind of that's not how gigs were at that time. It's how gigs are now,
yes,
where people go to the front and stare.
I think this is
shout.
The thing. These were dances,
yes,
previously.
Yeah.
So this seems to mark, you know, I suppose maybe you say this is the beginning of the modern rock gig. I mean, up to this point, it was a band played for a dance.
And they were playing for the purposes of the dance. You weren't going for the band
You weren't
themselves.
Going to see a concert. You were going to a dance at which there was a live band providing the entertainment.
So it's the force of their personality, their talent, their ability that people are paying more attention to them than the function of dancing. And then they end 1960 by playing another gig at the Casbah Club. So it's an interesting Christmas 1960. From one side of Christmas Day, they're almost on the verge of collapse. And then on the other side of Christmas Day, they realise what they've done.
Yes, and Lewison makes the point that this is really where they cemented their local following.
Yes.
So you had then people were coming to follow the band at this point. So it wasn't just, there's an event or there's a dance and the Beatles are playing. People were then following the band. And this is the start of that sort of dedicated, loyal, local following.
Yeah, they basically just make a name in Liverpool across Christmas 1960.
Yeah.
And then they become like
this is when the local promoters suddenly latch on to this. And the Beatles had been a little bit sort of suspect. You know, they were a little bit unreliable. There had been sort of problems with them sort of turning up or not turning up, or maybe fights at that. But this is the point at which the local promoters suddenly realize there's money to be made.
Yes. Okay, so that's 1960. Pretty pivotal. They're still pre any kind of national fame. They're still far away from a record contract. Let's skip forward 12 months to 1961, because in 1961 they had gigged a lot.
Yeah.
And you kind of look at the numbers. They played 36 gigs in February 1961 alone. They'd done 3 months in Hamburg, playing up to 8 hours per night for about 92 nights in a row. They became fully involved in the Cavern Club gigs. And by the end of 1961, in November 1961, obviously, very important thing, on the 9th of November, Brian Epstein sees them for the first time and starts the process of trying to become their manager. So a load of things happen in December 1961 that sets them up for 1962. So where would you start? I suppose, you know, in December 1961, they start playing. They played their first gig outside of Liverpool. They go down to the south of England.
Yes. So this was this was in Aldershot, at the Palais Ballroom. And this was a local Liverpool promoter, Sam Leach, who decided if we can't get A&R men to come to Liverpool, then we will go to them. And for some reason, he seems to think that Aldershot is London.
Right.
So, you know, Aldershot is, what, sort of 35 miles outside London. This is the early 60s. It's not the most easily accessible. But his idea was he was going to book them for 5 consecutive Saturday nights at the Palais Ballroom. Mm-hmm. And this was going to be a showcase that was really going to put them on the map with A&R and record companies. And it was billed as Liverpool versus London, Battle of the Bands. You had the Beatles, and you had a London group called Ivor Jay and the Jaywalkers.
Oh, yes.
And
Where are they now?
So this was the big event that was going to break them. And for one reason or another, it just didn't happen. Not least of which, Aldershot, not London.
It's not really the... I've never been to Aldershot, but it's not.
I've been to Aldershot.
Have you?
Yeah. It's an army town.
Ah, okay.
It's a kind of army town, but it's very nice. You know, all our people living
Shout
in Aldershot.
Out to Aldershot
the streets are not filled with roaming record company A&R men. I think that's
the problem. Is true. That's well known.
Aldershot known for that. But Leach, two issues apart from the geographical inconvenience. It wasn't advertised anywhere.
Right.
So he claimed to have sent an advert to the local, you know, the Aldershot News, but for some reason the ad didn't run.
Yes.
I think there was some background story about, you know, the paper only accepted cash for first-time advertisers or some such, but for whatever reason, the gig was just not advertised. So I think that the head count was 18 people turned up.
Well, what's interesting about this kind of December 1961 period is Epstein's just appeared on the scene, and he's doing a lot of work for them to kind of prove his bona fides, but he hasn't signed them to any contract yet.
He's really working on SPAC. It's on trust at this stage.
Yes, and in some ways he's trying to prove himself, and there's probably, you know, a bit of, the Beatles are expecting him to kind of deliver something. And then on Wednesday, the 13th of December, they're playing their gigs in the Cavern Club. They're doing their 64th lunchtime gig of 1961 in the Cavern Club. And again, through Epstein, there's an A&R man there to see the Beatles for the first time.
Yes, Mike Smith from Decca, he comes to the evening show because Epstein, via Tony Barrow, who was Liverpudlian press guy, but working in London, had put him in touch.
And it's, you know, this is the series of events that leads to the Decca audition.
Yeah.
So that gets put in the diary for the 1st of January 1962 as a result of them being seen on the 13th of December in the Cavern. But then Christmas week, again, Epstein working on spec, he organises the band's first ever photo session. And he finally also puts together a management contract to get them to have a look at it. And also Christmas week, they're playing the Cavern every day. So it's full tilt. For the Beatles.
I think this is Epstein stepping up into the role of what he perceives to be the role of a manager. You know, he's never done this before.
Yeah.
The Beatles, I think, are probably more impressed by his car and his clothes and his manner.
Yeah.
He has no managerial experience, but he is sort of feeling his way into the role. As you say, they get... I think I have a name somewhere. Albert Marion
did
the first photos. He's a wedding photographer, and I think he takes 16, 17 photographs, and that's the official first publicity shots.
But it's a perfectly kind of Brian Epstein thing, because you can't really imagine the Beatles themselves arranging their own photographs or understanding what it means. Whereas, you know, it's a perfectly normal managerial process to say, okay, we're going to get some photos, get them done, we'll send these out, get you known. And start to get them suited and booted up, you know.
Yes, I mean, this is the start of him sort of bringing them more into the mainstream.
Yes.
As you say, cleaning them up, putting them into suits, etc.
And so a draft contract is put towards them, but they don't finally sign with Brian until January 62. But Christmas 1961 is the last Christmas they are without a record contract.
Yeah.
And that is obviously the number one thing that Brian Epstein wants them to get. And he's putting a lot of trust in... Decca hopefully wanted to accept the Beatles after the 1st of January audition, but we know that doesn't turn out to be the case. Do you know what songs were number one for Christmas 1961 by any chance?
I don't know, but I'm sure you have a list.
I do have a list. In the UK, the number one Christmas single was Moon River by Andy Williams, and in the US it was The Lion Sleeps Tonight by The Tokens. So they are two respectable songs, but very much a pre-Beatle era that, you know, all this is going on, Christmas 1961, and you know, we don't know what's about to happen. So then you skip forward to Christmas 1962. And by Christmas 1962, we are in a totally different space again.
Yes.
So by Christmas 1962, they have a record contract. They have put out a debut single, Love Me Do, obviously, through Parlophone. And what they've also done in that year is they've signed up to Epstein, and they are working. They are a proper gigging band, and you know, they tour. They start touring all around the country in 1962. So they make their first television appearances towards the end of 1962.
Yes, so this is sort of early December. They're promoting Love Me Do. 3rd of December, they go to Bristol for a television show called Discs A Go-Go. I would like to see that show. And this was a weekly pop music show that was broadcast live, so I don't think there's a tape or recording of that. It's their only appearance on the show, and they mime to Love Me Do. So you think of miming as being a modern
phenomenon.
Yeah. But they're miming to Love Me Do. The next day, on the 4th, the Tuesday, they're on a kids show.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see how this persists, this type of publicity persists all the way through to today. This time it's television in the London area, and again they're miming to Love Me Do, and part of a miming section to P.S. I Love You as well.
And so what is interesting though about the end of 62 is that for actual Christmas 1962 they do end up going back to Hamburg. Now it's in a slightly different situation to when they've been in Hamburg before. It's a short residency for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Slightly better pay, slightly better circumstances. But it really is one of the few instances in, you know, the Beatles chronology where you kind of think, that's a bit regressive. You don't really need to go to Hamburg at this point.
I think that's right. And, you know, this was something that had been arranged, contracted before sort of the single and the touring in the UK started to take off. I think the Beatles weren't particularly happy about going, but again, Epstein, contract is a contract. You've got to see this out. And of course, they're back in Hamburg this time with Ringo.
The first and only time they're in Hamburg with Ringo. So it's something old and something new at the same time, you know?
And I mean, one of the things that had happened by this point is they're scoping out, what are they going to do for an album? So George Martin has been to see them in the Cavern and decided that this is not going to happen. This is not an appropriate venue. But then, as you say, they fly back to Hamburg on the 18th.
Yes, and it's their final residency at the Star Club. And they were contracted to play for 13 nights from the 18th to the 31st of December with a break for Christmas Day. And they stayed at a hotel this time called the Hotel Pacific. And on December the 25th itself, which was a Tuesday in 1962, it's their only day off in Hamburg, and they're not really living the VIP lifestyle yet. They go off to the Siemens Mission, the British Siemens Mission in Hamburg, and which was known as a place where you could get warm food and a bit of heat and a drink. And
it seems very strange that you know, this is a band with a record in the charts, Christmas Day.
Yeah. You wouldn't, you know. Yes. And they had Christmas lunch with another band called the Dominoes, and apparently they ate horse.
Yeah, very tasty too.
Oh my Lord. So, but it's a different Christmas to the previous Christmases, and, you know, they finish in Hamburg and then they fly back to start 1963 back in the UK.
Another tour.
So let's go forward then to Christmas and December 1963, because this is a massive sea change, and this is Beatlemania.
Yeah.
Beatlemania is now fully in swing for Christmas 1963. Let's talk about the first Beatles Christmas record, because this is the first time they now have a fan base.
Yes.
And so, you know, something that's kind of popped up in the last few years is that the Beatles Christmas records have kind of come back into the popular consciousness. So for people who don't know, the Beatles Christmas records were, what, just an annual fan club specific present?
Yes, this was something. I mentioned Tony Barrow, who was a sort of an associate of Epstein. So he's working as a press officer now, and he came up with the idea that they should do something as a gift or a thank you to the fans.
Yes.
Because by this stage, you know, they have a massive fan club in the UK. As you say, Beatlemania is taking off.
Yeah.
The Beatles were sort of, okay, yes, let's do that, but they left it to Tony Barrow to script something.
Yes.
And on the 17th of October 1963, they sit down in a studio with that script. They're just about to start work on I Want to Hold Your Hand. So it gives you an idea of that kind of tipping point again. Yes. It's the next big leap forward is just about to happen.
And so we talked about I Want to Hold Your Hand on a separate episode. But yes, they're doing this. She Loves You is becoming almost the biggest selling history in biggest selling single in UK history. They're trying to record I Want to Hold Your Hand. I Want to Hold Your Hand is going to be the Christmas number one for that year in the UK. So they set up to do this fan club record.
And I mean, it's so we're just about to get that single. We're just about to get the release of With the Beatles.
Yes.
The hysteria is there in their day to day lives.
So their lives months of Please Please Me.
Their lives have been turned inside out. And there's a nice article in Rolling Stone, and they talk about these records, and this one in particular, and they say a genuine tone of naive bewilderment pervades the recording. So it's a very straight script.
Yes.
Where each of them in turn simply steps up to the microphone and goes, we'd just like to thank you. We hope we pleased you. There's Tony Barrow working in little references to Please Please Me. And it's all very traditional showbiz.
Yes.
You get little bits of the Beatles' personality coming through and kind of undercutting this, where John saying, you know, I'd like to personally respond to you all, but I don't have enough pens. You know, but they're pretty...
It's pretty square.
Is the word.
But the thing I'm interested because you know I think it's what 2 years ago, 3 years ago that the Beatles Christmas records were reissued as a very nice box, and we just have it sitting in front of us here for no particular reason. but I'm not sure. Was this a common thing that was happening at the time? It seems to me in retrospect, the Beatles fan club and how it interacted with people was very progressive for the time.
Yes, I think so. I'm not aware that anyone was doing this. I mean, I suppose the comparables would have been in an earlier era, people like Frank Sinatra or people like Elvis. But I think I'm not aware of anyone doing this before. And these just for people that don't know, these were little one-track one-sided flexi discs.
Yes.
The sort of thing that if you play them half a dozen times, they would start to deteriorate in quality.
And they certainly weren't the type of thing that they expected back in October 1963 to be poured over many, many years later in a recording studio trying to figure out what it's all about.
You're sitting there with the box set and you know, these are being sort of polished up and cleaned up, and it's a very nice thing to have. But I find myself thinking, you know, where are the outtakes? Where are the? Because Tony Barrow, the press officer, was basically given the master tape.
Yes.
And he did the editing for the first one, and he said literally he sat with scissors and chopped up the master tape and stuck it together. And he said all of the little outtakes and snippets just lay on the studio floor and were swept up. So, on the basis that anything the Beatles said or did is now worthy of me paying money for it.
Well, the first flexi came in a little sleeve, and the back of the sleeve has pictures of the Beatles with the fan club joint secretaries of the time, Bettina Rose and Anne Collingham, and also a lovely picture of the Beatles meeting the Queen Mother on the back.
The fan club secretaries and Frida Kelly,
good old Frida.
They get a shout out.
They do.
And one of the things that's interesting is Paul in his little section. And again, how much this is him and how much is Tony Barrow. He says, you know, people ask us, you know, what do you like best? You know, do you like playing live or what aspect? And he said, the thing we like best is being in the studio and making records.
Yes.
So it's interesting whether that's a scripted line or whether that's Paul sort of saying, well, actually, you know, we much prefer seeing this come together in the studio. That's the way they're heading. You know, it's maybe early to say, well, he's looking ahead 3 years to the touring getting tiresome. The other thing I think is interesting, he says, what we like to hear most is one of our songs taking shape in a recording studio, one of the ones that John and I have written.
Right. Very pointed there.
Very pointed, given that it was a month earlier they'd recorded George's first song. I'm just doing the Team George.
that's for this week.
It wouldn't be an episode if I didn't.
Big up George.
Yeah.
So by 63, it's Beatlemania, Christmas number ones. There's all the stuff we talked about in previous episodes going on in the background about prepping them up for the US of A. So their single comes out in the US on the 26th of December 1963. But the other big thing that they do across Christmas, and which we might think is quaint, but when you look at it is quite smart, is the Beatles Christmas show at Finsbury Park,
yes,
Astoria, which is a way of, I guess, trying to meet demand for tickets on behalf of Brian Epstein, really.
I think so. So that you've got that, I suppose, this notion of a residency,
yeah,
that they're going to do. They sell 100,000
tickets,
yeah, which is just crazy.
Yeah, I didn't realize it was that many. If you add up all the different shows and that they played that Christmas,
yeah,
and all the tickets sold, 100,000. So you'd think now you wouldn't blink an eye of,
yeah,
a big band selling 100,000 tickets two or three nights in a stadium or whatnot.
Yeah.
But how did you do that in 1963? You just did a residency like
you
this.
You just did a residency. And
yeah,
it's a peculiar mix of, you know, songs and sketches. And you know, you could see this is a throwback to the kind of old Mr. Showbiz style,
yeah,
entertainment, you know, the kind of thing that the mums and dads would be going to see, you know, Vic Parnell at the London Palladium and that type of thing. So it's a slightly uneasy mix of bands and sketches and a sort of pantomime.
Yes. Well, obviously, the British tradition of pantomime,
yeah,
is where people would be spending their box office money at Christmas time.
You know, you've got Cilla Black, the Baron Knights,
yeah,
Rolf Harris.
Let's not.
But I don't know where the Finsbury Astoria is. I've never been to the Finsbury.
Well,
Astoria.
I have been to the Finsbury. Well, here's an interesting thing, because
is it still there?
I mentioned it is still there. So many years ago, I lived in London, and I lived in the North London area, and I used to get a bus past this very spectacular building, and I didn't for all intents and purposes, it was a church. It was one of these kind of modern Christian churches. And I was flicking through a Beatles book one day, and I saw a picture, and I realized that building was the Finsbury Park Astoria, which later became the Rainbow. So the building still exists, but it's now a church, but it's still an auditorium. And I managed to get in and look around the foyer and all the rest, but I couldn't get into the auditorium on the day. They're very nice. They're very understanding. And I knocked on the door and said, can I have a look around, please? But there's pictures of the auditorium, and it's still there. I think they're called the UKCG Church or something like that.
Okay.
And the deal that was made was it was a venue up until the early 1980s. And there was some group who wanted to open a venue, and it was between they had a deal with this church, and they swapped venues, and it was the Brixton Academy.
Oh, okay.
That the church gave to the promotions venue, and they gave the church the old Finsbury Park Rainbow.
I didn't know that the Astoria was the Rainbow.
The Astoria
every
is the
day
Rainbow.
Is a school day.
Every day is a school day. So it's all the same building. So there is recordings from inside. There's a very celebrated Kinks gig that was filmed,
yeah,
inside the Rainbow,
yeah,
in,
yeah,
the 70s. If you want to get an idea of what that arena was like. On Christmas Day itself, 1963, they were not working. And as a step up from the previous year, eating horse at the Seamen's Mission, they get a private plane up to Liverpool to spend time with their family.
For the day. And then back to London the next day.
Back to London
to
do shows.
So no time off, really.
Yes, and it cost £400 to charter a private plane to Liverpool for Christmas Day 1963, which is £8,000 in today's money, which, if you're selling 100,000 tickets, that's...
Yeah, it's probably worthwhile.
A drop in the ocean. So when they're standing in Liverpool on Christmas Day 1963, they must be thinking, well, where can we go next?
Yeah.
And the following day, their single comes out in the US. And as we know, that becomes quite popular.
Well, that's I Want to Hold Your Hand.
I Want to Hold Your Hand.
That's, again, it's again that next step.
And the
next step up.
Just as a side point, the song that was number one in the USA for Christmas 1963 was Dominique by the Singing Nun. So talk about a new broom coming in to clean that out.
Yes, I think we touched on that on the whenever we talked about the single. And the other statistic was it was selling 10,000 copies an hour in New York within a few days.
So let's skip into Christmas 1964. And by the end of 1964, they're not just a Liverpool phenomenon or a UK phenomenon or a European. They are a worldwide phenomenon. They are the biggest pop culture, rock music sensation that the world has ever known at that point. And they're kind of in uncharted waters by the time you get to Christmas 64. How do you get this big? Where do you go next? Well,
yes, I think that's the point. This had never been done on this scale before. You know, you'd had the kind of Sinatra, you'd had Elvis, but nothing as sort of as global as this.
Yes. And so what they actually end up doing is they do another run of Christmas shows at the Hammersmith Odeon. So they do, I think, two shows a day, which run until the 16th of January. So they're back doing what's called literally another Beatles Christmas show. And, you know, you could argue, is it a bit parochial to be going back to doing this? But again, how do you sell that many tickets? How do you meet demand? What do you do?
I think this is the thing. The other thing to bear in mind, to put it in context, is this is England in the early 60s.
Yes.
So the template for sort of showbiz, and that's really what we're talking about, is showbiz.
Yes.
For success is this kind of variety show, the Palladium. Mm-hmm. That's the template for how you actually work this. The fact that the Beatles had sort of completely outgrown this, and I think you're right. I think this is them being sort of shoehorned into something, into a format that they weren't happy with this.
Yes.
I think they again, it was sort of music, other bands. Again, you have the Mike Cotton sound, you have Freddie and the Dreamers. Interesting, you have the Yardbirds.
Mm-hmm.
So again, there's that kind of slightly harder edge. And following on from the Rolf Harris theme, this year's compere is Jimmy Savile.
Oh, Jesus.
So anyway, so they have, and again, they're being made to do these little skits and sketches and things like that. And I think they pretty much say, that's it. We're not doing that again.
Well, people are trying to figure this out. I mean, they still haven't done Shea Stadium in the US. No. So stadiums haven't come onto the agenda yet. And, you know, bands doing, I know the Empire Pool starts to become a place where gigs are done and Enemy shows and all the rest. But that hasn't become like a standard go-to place for people to play. So they're still trying to negotiate, how do you be big? You know, what do you do for these kind of things? And so by Christmas 1964, there's what's called another Beatles Christmas record is given out to the fans, which we have there. And that's a bit looser. That's a bit more, I mean, listen, they're kings of the world at that point. They can kind of say what they want, can't they?
It is. And interestingly, Tony Barrow, in his, everyone's written a book. His book is John, Paul, George, Ringo and Me. He says the Beatles, the Beatles approached him saying, oh, when are we doing the Christmas record?
Right.
So at this point, they obviously realized this. The Beatles are enjoying this. This is something that they had fun doing. He says, you know, he scripted something for them, but really they were using his words as a sort of security blanket, that they were just going to go in, they were going to mess around, but they knew they had a they had a script.
Yeah, and Tony Barrow writes some sleeve notes on the back, and it's a nice portrait of the Beatles on the front. It's still got that. That Beatles logo of the curly script with the little antenna on the B that hasn't really lasted as long as the drop T Beatles logo, and George kind of looks a bit strange on the cover of that. He sort of has a Dave Clark type appearance. It's not the best picture of George, but it's again a very important outreach to the fans. The songs that are number one at Christmas 1964, it's basically the Beatles Christmas. I Feel Fine is number one in the UK and the US. Beatles for Sale, the album, is number one in the UK, and I Feel Fine goes number one all around the world: Sweden, Norway, New Zealand, Netherlands, Canada and Ireland. And the number one US album for Christmas Day, Beach Boys Concert. So not a total clean sweep.
Certainly
a change.
This Christmas record is the one that I think is the least impressive. They all sound tired. It sounds slightly forced. And I suppose that ties in with the Beatles for Sale, that general notion.
Well, there's a parallel universe where 64 is them running out of steam.
Yes.
And they were like, well, that was fun, wasn't it? Because Beatles for Sale doesn't necessarily tell us what's about to happen in 65, 66 and everything else. You know, it's covers and a bit. It's not the best album.
No.
I know. I
agree with you. There is that sense of just, it's all getting to be too much for them. The treadmill is moving too quickly, and they don't have any time. This Christmas record is part of the final session for the Beatles for Sale LP. So they are tired, and you get a sense of a slight, they're jaded.
Yes.
I mean, at one point, you know, McCartney, who's always up and always on, and he says something,
great,
you know, we were really great for the fans, and we don't know where we'd be without you. And in the background, Lennon says, in the army. You know, or Harrison says, the next film's going to be in colour. And Lennon goes, yeah, it's going to be green. You know, so they just seem a little bit jaded, I think.
Yes. And in the US, they give their first fan club a Christmas record, but it's actually just an edit of the 1963 record. So they haven't kind of matched on both sides of the Atlantic. But when you kind of look at it, across those five Christmases from 1960 to 1964, you know, they've gone from, you know, returning from Hamburg destitute to being on top of the world at the end of 1964.
Yeah.
And you kind of think, well, where else is there to go? They can't go into space. And you know, what we'll talk about in part two is that the only way they can kind of go is to go inward.
Yes.
And that's exactly why we kind of get that tilt into the second part of the Beatles' career. But we're going to have to talk about that on next week's part two of The Beatles at Christmas. We would hope that you'll stay in touch with us in the usual places. Subscribe to us on Twitter at BeatlesPod. If you go onto Facebook and look for the Nothing Is Real Facebook group, you can join us there and join the conversation. And we're going to put out part two in 1 week's time. So make sure you're all subscribed in all the usual places, and all nice words and reviews that are left behind are appreciated. But for now, I'm Jason Carty.
I'm Stephen Cockcroft.
And this has been Nothing Is Real. We will see you next time.